introduce our main speaker for this evening, Tricia G. from San Diego.
Hi, my name is Trisha. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Larry for inviting me to speak here. This is my first time at this meeting. This is a great group, and I see a lot of familiar faces that I haven't seen for some time, which is really cool. Three things that are really important to me. I have a sobriety date. It's January 9th, 2005. I have a sponsor. It's Elizabeth F. And I have a home group. It is a Step in Tradition workshop over the bridge in La Mesa on Thursday nights. You're welcome to come and join us at 8 o'clock. You know, the book says, I was thinking about that, you know, I can honestly stand up here today and say that I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I can honestly say that I never thought I'd be able to say that because I thought that I was a chronic relapser. And I'll talk more about that as I share my story. I was asked to share what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. So what I was like. Grew up in one of those families. I was the youngest, had three stepbrothers and a sister and mom and dad, and the party was always on. I remember being 5 years old, and there'd be parties at the house, and I knew how to make the cocktails for the guests, and I knew that there was some powerful elixir in those drinks that I was, you know, making for people, that it was really important to them to have those drinks. And a little bit older, you know, it was not uncommon at my home to wake up in the middle of the night to some noise, and usually it was my stepdad who was totally drunk and, you know, had his shotguns out and was in the backyard firing them and, you know, all sorts of fun stuff like that. And I have fond memories of the SWAT team showing up and, you know, me being in my pajamas and me and my sister being, you know, escorted away because the house was so crazy. You know, I mean, and it was drinking. I mean, everybody in my house drank, and that's what it was about. And that was kind of, you know, that was my normal. That's what I knew as normal. But as the youngest, my role in the family was, you know, to try and smooth things out, to try and make everybody happy and make sure everybody was okay. And as I grew up, I got to see that, you know, alcohol really wasn't that good, that it was, you know, there were fights going on and you know, people weren't nice when they got drunk, and I decided that I didn't want to drink like them. You know, I was a good student, I was a good girl, I was a nice girl, and that's what I was going to continue to do. Well, that didn't last too long. For me, it was more of the teenage years where, you know, we'd have parties, and you'd either be, you know, smoking your alcohol or drinking your alcohol, either way, you know, but I just kind of got exposed to that just through the social thing. But I still had those examples of what alcohol would do to an adult, and I didn't really like what I was seeing, what was done. So I guess somehow in my later teen years, I came to the conclusion that, you know, the drinking of the alcohol was something I didn't want to do, but the smoking of the alcohol was something that I could do. And I say that because this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I want to adhere to that. So my mom is actually here tonight, and my mom was a good example to me of how you drink. And so it's a little odd speaking when my mom's in the room. I'd like to thank Natalie for coming with me tonight. I get to work with her, and it's a pleasure. It's really a gift to be able to share what I have gotten with someone else and watch them get it. But anyway, so the craziness went on in the family, and I continued to find my way in this world, find the ability to be comfortable in my own skin through smoking alcohol. And And then at some point, the craziness got really bad. There was a lot of abuse in my family. Any type you can think of, it was there. And so I pretty much got out of there in my early 20s and got out of there with my mom, and we became roommates. And it was a really cool situation because, you know, if I ran out of the alcohol that I was smoking, I would just borrow some from my mom or, you know, find her stash and take it. And you know, if I did get thirsty, there was, you know, stuff in the refrigerator for me to drink. So it was a really cool environment. So I never really did feel comfortable in my own skin. I remember being 19 and going to therapy because, you know, I figured it was just the traumatic childhood that I had and the things that had been done to me that made me feel so odd. You know, I either had to be so much better than you or I was such a piece of, you know, poo. I mean, I just, you know, so much better or so much worse. You know, I did not know that meaning of just being one among many. And I was so self-conscious and so insecure, so self-centered, I know now. So when I did this therapy route, he had suggested that I try a 12-step program. And I remember going to a sister fellowship and talking about what my drug of choice was, and they kind of laughed at me because it was so minor in their mind. So I went back to this psychiatrist and told him that they laughed at me. And he said, well, you know, there's an AA meeting in this facility on Friday nights. You know, maybe you should try that one. I hear it's a really good meeting. So I remember being, now I was really intimidated because my first try at a 12-step program didn't work too well. So I remember asking my mom if she would go with me. So mom and I went to this AA meeting and, you know, sit in this room and we're going around the rooms introducing ourselves and gets to my mom and you know, she says, I'm Lana Sue and I'm an alcoholic. And she started crying and cried throughout the rest of the meeting. And I couldn't believe that she said that because that we weren't there for her. We were there for me. And but that woman hasn't had a drink since. And so that became my new example. You know, before it was the woman who would, you know, tear it up the night before, wake up in the morning, you know, go walk Cow's Mountain and then come home and drink a beer, you know, and that was the example that I had of, oh, this is how you live life. And so now I had a sober mom as an example. And, you know, that run at sobriety for me didn't stick. I was 19 and I was not ready. And off I went to college, and I met a him. And the him didn't like the smoking of the alcohol that I was doing, but he sure taught me how to drink well, much better than I had known up to that point. Up to that point, I would have a six-pack of Coors Light in my refrigerator for a week. And shortly, it became an 18-pack a day. You know, I mean, it progressed really quick, and Jack Daniels became my best friend, and that's what I liked, was shots of whiskey and beer. I mean, that was what the way I liked to drink, and ended up moving down to the beach and getting into that beach scene and the bars and, you know, just get on your bike and, you know, find your way home. There's a seawall. If you crash, you just fall into the seawall, and, you know, it was the life. I was living the life, and I had arrived. I had arrived. I remember... this is just one of those, like, aha moments that I had was prior to meeting this person, I was so insecure. I remember I couldn't even, like, go into a fast food place or a restaurant by myself, you know, and eat because everyone's looking at me and they know that I have no friends and, oh, my God, you know, it's all about me, 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 me. And then, you know, alcohol, wow, you know, I could go anywhere, any place, no worries. I had confidence, you know. I had arrived. It was great. And I really did have a great time. My life was all about drinking and sports, you know, watching sports and drinking. That was my life. So I married this him, and it was, you know, it was good. It was good until it wasn't. And for me, what happened is it happened really quick for me. I really feel that way when I look at my story. I had graduated from college and you know, became a CPA and was working in for a company and had a really good job and really enjoyed partying. And it got to the point where, you know, I was calling in sick on Monday and calling in sick on Tuesday. And, you know, in some weeks it would be Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Kind of the progression that I saw, various things. So I remember having a really good opportunity at work to do a presentation to senior management. I had worked really hard for it. And I remember when I would get home from work, I would try and count the number, try and find that exact mix that would get me lit up the way I wanted to get lit up that night, but then I'd still be able to wake up the next morning and actually go to work. And I remember thinking, okay, it's 4 beers and 2 shots. That's the magic number for me, you know? And so that night before this big presentation, I remember thinking, okay, 4 beers and 2 shots. And that didn't work. And I never made it to work the next day, you know? And the book talks about that, you know? I had every reason not to overshoot that mark, you know? I had a great opportunity awaiting for me that next day at work, and the alcohol won. I had no control. And then, so the other thing that started to happen is I would get off work, and before I would even, you know, I mean, the freeway was right there, but I couldn't get on the freeway. I had to go the back route to get to the gas station to get the 18-pack so that I'd have my roadies on the way home. You know, that was more important. So then I realized, well, that's silly. Why don't I just pack 2 beers in my lunch bag? And then I have them for as soon as I get off work. I can just have my roadies on the way home. And then I was drinking those at lunch, so it still wasn't working. And then I also remember, you know, the pain of trying to brush my teeth in the morning to go to work and throwing up. And just that, you know, it was like day in, day out, because there wasn't a night that I didn't rip it. I mean, it was on every night. And so then it got to the point where instead of filling coffee into my coffee mug for the travel on the way to work, I was filling my coffee mug with beer to settle my stomach so that I could start the day. And, you know, I knew that wasn't good, you know, and my husband was looking at me funny. And you know, there was many a Saturday where, you know, I'd get up and I'd have my 2 cups of coffee and look at the clock and it was 10 and I'm like, yeah, it's beer time, you know. And by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm passed out. I mean, Wife of the Year award, you know, I mean, it's just, it wasn't good. It wasn't good at all. And so during all this, my mom had stayed sober. And I had watched her go through a really difficult divorce. And she ended up coming and staying sober through it all. And she ended up coming to live with us. And I remember it was around Thanksgiving. You know, and I remember my mom watching me, but never saying, you know, you are disgusting. You are a drunk. You need this AA thing, you know, and shoving that down my throat. She never did that. She just watched me and, you know, would go and do her AA meetings and just, you know, didn't try and push it on me. And so I remember it was around Thanksgiving because I woke up and we got the bird in the oven and, you know, whew, that was hard work, you know, so we got to start on. I'm going to drink wine today because it's Thanksgiving and it's classy. So I remember drinking the wine and I think it was by like 1 o'clock in the afternoon or so, I was just done and spilt wine all over the floor and the carpet, and there's Mom helping me clean this up, you know. And it wasn't too long after that that I just finally got to the point of saying, I need help, you know. And so I went to my first treatment center, and I remember thinking, you know, in my self-importance that I had, you know, I was all of that. And I remember thinking, how are they going to survive without me for 28 days at work? The books are going to be so screwed up. There's no way they can survive without me. Well, they survived without me. And you know, so I got out of that treatment center and you know, like our 10-minute speaker, Derek, had said, I learned how to be a model student. But see, it wasn't that I was trying to pull one over on them. I really thought that I had learned so much about myself, the self-knowledge that I had. You know, that now I've learned this inner workings of my mind, and I've learned so much about myself that, you know, I'm going to do okay from here on out. And the social worker at that treatment center had suggested to my husband that it might be easier for my recovery if he didn't drink around me. And so he decided, okay, I won't drink for 90 days. And so it was about day 80, And he came home from work on a Friday, and he said, you know, I've had a really crappy day, and I just need to let you know I'm going to go to the bar and have a couple drinks, and I'll be home. And I said, that's cool. Well, I need to let you know that I'm going to go with you, but I got a plan. And my plan was, here's the deal. We'll go to the bar, and we'll have two beers, maybe a shot, but we're not going to go to the grocery store and buy any beer. We're just going to go to the bar. And then tomorrow morning, Saturday, I'm going to wake up and go to my women's meeting like I normally do, and everything's going to be great. I mean, I seriously thought that I could work both angles. You know, it's like the book talks about that, that I didn't have that thought of the horrific consequences of what it would be. But then again, this was my first time around. You know, I really didn't know. And so I don't really remember what happened that night. I don't know if we got beer or not. But I do know that I called in sick Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And I do know that I ended up back into a treatment, this time an outpatient. And that started the road of the treatment centers for me. And I went to many treatment centers, in and out, in and out. I would get the gold stars. I would get the counselor saying, you know, like in the doctor's opinion when it talks about, you know, have to have this spiritual experience, you know, that I had had this, you know, and here's your model student, Tricia. You know, everyone wants to be like her. And you know, next thing you know, I was drinking. And that went on for about 3 years, in and out, in and out. And there was a women's meeting that I had been going to regularly. And, you know, during that period of time, thank goodness that every time that I came in, you know, beaten up with my tail between my legs, they just welcomed me back. You know, they welcomed me back and, you know, just circled me. And so, like I said, that went on for about 3 years. The most time that I got was 11 months. I remember my sponsor at that time had actually bought me a one-year token. She was really excited that she was going to be able to give me a cake, and I went out again. And I guess it was so much on her that her sponsor had said, you need to let her go. And so she ended up letting me go at the same time that the husband ended up letting me go. And so I was in, you know, I've got this abandonment issues going on now, and you know, I'm seeking more counseling and more therapy. Not that anything's wrong with that. I'm not saying that at all. My experience is that the best that a counselor could do for me, and this was someone who was an alcoholic who I had met at a treatment center that I was at, was tell me that because of the damage that was done to me as a child at the early age, that my brain had never developed properly and that I was never going to be able to continue in my career or have a successful relationship, and that I should probably contact the California Rehabilitation Center because they have programs and monies and things like that. That was the best he could do for me besides, you know, give me all sorts of pills. And I am so grateful today that somehow, some way, I found my way back into AA. And this is how I really see it happening. So that ex-husband and I, we tried to work it out. You know, we went through counseling and tried to get back together. And through that process, we realized that we just were not on the same path anymore. Our union was so much about drinking and sports, and I just couldn't drink anymore. You know, and we really didn't have much going on after that. So through counseling, we had come to terms as to how we're going to do the property settlement and not involve lawyers and all this kind of stuff. And so I had done all the paperwork that I needed to do, and at the last minute, he decided that he changed his mind. Well, that day I had been drinking a little bit. Imagine that. And I was livid. I absolutely lost it when he said that, and I swung at him. And I'm a total chick hitter. I mean, you know, and I think I might have brushed his ear or something like that. And he had some paper that had come in the fax, and he was holding it, and I'm trying to get it from him. So I stretched out his sweatshirt. Well, next thing you know, he's calling the cops. So off I went. Bye-bye. You know, I went and ended up getting loaded and coming home really late, and ended up getting some of that alcohol that you smoke. And I was sitting there in the house the next day, because at this time I'm not working, you see, because I'm disabled. That's what the disabled, and I don't need to work, so I'm not working. And I'm sitting there in my home, and my table in front of me has paraphernalia and stuff on it, And all of a sudden, just something hit me, you know, all of the time that I had spent in AA, and it hit me, and it said, you know, this is not the solution, Tricia. This is not the solution. And somehow I got up and I flushed all that stuff and threw everything away. And probably about an hour later, I hear a knock on the front door. And I'm just like, I'm not going to answer the door. You got to be kidding me. And the way my house is, I'm sitting in my living room, and that would be the front door, and you can walk around and get in the backyard. And so I'm sitting there, and I see something out of the corner of my eye, and there's a cop at the back door saying, aren't you going to open the front door for my officer? And I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, you know. So once again, you know, in hindsight, I see my higher power looking out for me right then and there, because had they showed up an hour earlier, the charges would have been a little bit more severe. So needless to say, he had a restraining order. I was removed from my home. It was only supposed to be for a weekend. It ended up being a month. Tail between my legs, I go and I stay with my mom. At this point, I'm suicidal. I don't give a hoot about anything. I don't give a hoot about the rules that my mom wants for her home. No drinking, no nothing inside of her home. I don't care. I'm just, you know, I don't care. I'm in such a dark spot, and I have no regard for anybody else. You know, I'm so much in my self-pity. And, but I was, you know, I told my mom, I said, you know, you've got pills in your medicine cabinet, and you need to remove those because I'm going to take them. But I was too afraid to take them. You know, I wanted to die, but I was a coward. Needless to say, that all worked out, and I got back into my house, and, you know, now it's on, okay? The party is now on, because I'm back in my house. I'm there with my kitties. The world is good. You know, I've got this house to remodel and get rid of him and all this kind of stuff, and got my alcohol. I don't have my mom looking over my shoulder. It's on, it's on, it's on. But the thing about it is, you know, I had all these great ideas, but I couldn't seem to get off the couch. So then I had a really good idea. There's this stuff that I remember from high school that will give me energy. So next thing you know, now I've got energy, and my, you know, I'm staying up all night, and I'm sleeping in the day, and I've got my stepbrother over there, you know, who he has energy too, and we're painting the house, and I'm not eating, and I mean, I'm messed up. I'm more messed up than I ever have been. And, you know, in hindsight, and that's the only way that I can see this, is that I no longer had to worry about losing a job. I no longer had to worry about losing a husband. When something came over me and said, you cannot do this, Tricia, you know what the solution is. You know that you're an alcoholic. You know that this is no way to live. That was for me. It wasn't for the job. It wasn't for the husband. It wasn't for the mom. It was for me. And that's the only thing in hindsight that I can say that was different this time around, because I didn't go to a treatment center with the sobriety that I have from January 9th, 2005. Every time before, I felt I needed to go somewhere and detox. I needed to go somewhere and get my gold star and have them tell me how good I was. So this time I, you know, just went to AA. I just went to AA. And started going to some different meetings and ran across a group of people who lived by the book. Not by the groovy little sayings that you hear in meetings. They lived by the book. And I had people show me things in this book that with the number of times that I had read it, you know, because believe me, I had sponsors, I had worked steps, I had commitments at meetings, so I couldn't figure out why I wasn't staying sober. And when I started my talk here and I talked about a chronic relapser, I didn't understand why I would go to these meetings and I would see people being able to stay sober, and how come I couldn't? Why wasn't I staying sober? You know, I was doing everything that they said. But really and truly, the difference for me is when I came into the rooms, I had a God. I didn't have a problem with the word God. And I didn't feel that I needed to do any work around God. I remember being in a treatment center, and the reading, we used to sit out in the sun every afternoon and read a chapter of the book. And when they suggested we read We Agnostics, I was not happy about that because I don't need to read We Agnostics. I'm not an agnostic. Let's read Into Action, you know. But really and truly, like that chapter, it has this second step proposition. In that chapter, it says either God is everything or God is nothing. You know, what was my decision to be? And what I came to terms to realize was that, you know, when I did my third step and I turned my will and my life over to the care of God, I wasn't turning my entire will and my entire life over to the care of God. I was turning over portions that I felt God needed and was holding on to the portions that I thought I could manage. And when that second step proposition that God is everything or He is nothing spoke to me, I realized that. You know, and the concept of a disease, you know, I can't use that word. I don't have a disease. This book doesn't tell me I have a disease. It says I have a spiritual malady. For me, when I say I have a disease, it takes me back to the concept that, you know, my brain has been damaged. I will no longer be able to function in a relationship. I cannot continue on with my career. I need to seek state help. That's what it means to me. For me, a disease means I need special treatment. A spiritual malady to me says I need to seek God. I need to seek a relationship with God. And, you know, those things made a huge difference for me. You know, there were just some things in the book that were absolutely profound to me that I had never experienced before. In the doctor's opinion, it talks about types of alcoholics. And then in the book, it in one of the chapters, I think it's more about alcoholism, it defines the word real alcoholic. Actually, it's their solution. And it talks about the real alcoholic. And, you know, in the first step, when it talks about fully concede to your innermost self that I'm a real alcoholic. So what the importance of that for me is that I had to learn and I had to fully concede to my innermost self that I'm a real alcoholic, and a real alcoholic as it was described in the book for me. You know, I don't know why other people were able to come to a meeting once a week and share about their husband, their dog, their cat, their job, not about the solution, and stay sober, and why I couldn't. I don't know. But I knew for me that I'm a real alcoholic. And this book helped me understand that. And actually, in that chapter, I circled the word real and really got a feel for what it was talking about. That was a big difference for me. I had another aha moment. It's in Fred's story in the book where he talks about spiritual principles will solve all of my problems. And I remember sitting in the meeting when I read that, and it was just like, doink, you know, like, oh, it doesn't say I'm not going to have problems. It says I'm going to have a spiritual solution that will solve all of my problems. So it really made a big difference for me getting around this group of people that were into the book and living in the solution. And, you know, living by these principles, it was huge for me. And I got a different sponsor and continued on a path and started working with other women. And I've had a lot happen in 7.5 years, as everybody does. It's life, you know. You don't just get sober and, life continues to happen. And you know, one of the big events I had is I had a major surgery, and I'm not good at asking for help. And it was one of those where I couldn't move, and I had to have people come over and help me. And I got to see this program in action, you know, people bringing me meetings, people coming over when I could actually get out in my wheelchair and loading me in their car and taking me to meetings. And, you know, that was a beautiful gift for me to experience, allowing people to help me, that I didn't have to take care of everything, you know. It was actually 1 year ago yesterday that this sponsor that taught me so much left the program, just out of the blue. Sent all of the gals that she sponsored, and we were really close-knit, and sent all of us gals a message that basically said, you know, I'm retiring and find yourself another sponsor. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it at first, and I gave it about 5 days of talking to my grand sponsor, who kept saying, you know, just give her more time, just give her more time. And you know, I'm of the mindset that I cannot do this by myself. I have to be actively sponsored, and I got myself a new sponsor, and I've continued on with a new journey with that. You know, the other thing that this book has taught me, you know, it talks in here about I have a new employer. That helps me in my career. It helps me in my work life, you know, when I remember that. When I remember that God is my employer and that I'm going to work for God, it just puts everything on a different keel for me. And believe me, I have so much more growth to do. I just switched jobs and, you know, I'm dealing with some stuff in regards to the reasoning as to why I switched jobs. I left a really, really good job, and I left it on a resentment. And I wasn't able to see it until I left, and now I'm kicking myself in the behind. But you know what? If nothing else, I got a really good lesson of humility. I got a really good lesson of seeing how I can, seeing how I can just live in a resentment and be delusional about it. You know, I do 10 steps. You know, I've been taught that I do written 10 steps. You know, because if I don't, I'm just leaving it up in my head and my filters are broken. Seriously, things come in and I get, you know, I can make it whichever way I want it to be. But when I'm actually putting pen to paper and I'm taking it out and I'm seeing my part, you know, and really looking at my defects, you know, that's where I am free. And, you know, I do 10 steps when I'm in the mood to be free. That's really what it comes down to. I'm not one of those that it's like, oh, goodness, that's a resentment. Where's my paper? I'm more of those that it's like, oh, I'm in so much pain now because I've had this resentment for a week that I need to write or I'm going to kill somebody. I mean, that's seriously, you know, it takes a lot of pain to get me to do it. But, it's a continual journey. Thank God that I don't have to, just because I've done the 12 steps and just because I've taken people through the steps and just because I have, you know, that I finally got past that year mark or whatever, you know, I don't get a diploma. I have not arrived. And I hope that I can forever remain teachable and open to whatever lesson God has in store for me, because I know He has more for me, you know, as time goes on. You know, the book talks about my real purpose, you know, is to be of maximum service to God and my fellows. And it doesn't say the fellows that I choose to be of real purpose to. It says to all fellows. And that's something for me to remember as well. And, you know, in my readings the other day, it talked about basically being willing to do whatever it is that God wants me to do, even when it interferes with my plans. And it even went as far to say, like, gladly be willing to do. Like, if somebody needs help or somebody, you know, something comes up and they need me to do something when I've got a plan, don't you know? To be gladly give up my idea for others. And, you know, the way that I do that today is I give back. I work with women. I take commitments at my meeting. I'm involved in the area. I'm having a really cool experience in general service and being on committees and doing all those meetings. And that's how I get to stay out of me, because otherwise, you know, I'd much rather be home watching So You Think You Can Dance, you know, rather than going to a meeting. I mean, there's things that I could fill my head with rather than filling myself with God's purpose for me, which, you know, when I remember what it talks about that, you know, my real purpose is to be of maximum, you know, maximum use to God and my fellows, you know, that's very helpful. And, you know, the other thing for me over this last year that I've really come to turn, actually over 2 years, that I've really been trying to incorporate into my program and into my way of thinking is, it says, real tolerance. I'm paraphrasing. Real tolerance of other people's viewpoints and opinions is what makes me more useful to others. And, you know, I went through a stage in my sobriety because of all of my ins and outs, and then finally getting on a path where I was able to have a few days under my belt and take a few cakes thinking that I knew that I had the solution to sobriety. My way was right. Your way was wrong. You're doing it wrong. This especially played out between me and my mother. This was always fun. And I got to experience, you know, real tolerance, you know, and that live and let live, you know. And again, I got to fully concede to my innermost self that I'm a real alcoholic, and I know what it is that I need to do. I know what it is that I do to stay sober. Rather or not I need to, I don't know, but I'm not willing to risk that. I'm not willing to give up this commitment or stop going to that meeting or not be of service there because I don't know what part of the puzzle is holding it all together. I do remember being desperate. I do remember wanting so badly to quit drinking, and I couldn't. I remember thinking, what have I done, God? How come you're not helping me? When really it came down to that I wasn't surrendering myself to God. I wasn't willing to let God have all of me. You know, and today I have a great life. I got remarried in the program, you know, have a sober home, and get to continue to learn and grow here, you know, through these tools, through these steps. And, you know, when Larry called and asked me to speak, I had a really good excuse because I was secretary of a Saturday night meeting, so I couldn't at that time because I had to be there. And then my term ended, and Larry kept calling me, and I know what it's like trying to get speakers for a large meeting, and so I surrendered and, you know, just realized that it's my turn. God thinks it's my turn, and I get to go and be of service. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak here tonight, and thank you all for listening. Okay.